Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk program. My name is Jack Brighton. Very glad you could listen today. Our guest during this hour of the show is the writer Orson Scott Card. Many of you will be familiar with his books, which include Ender's Game, Speaker for the Dead, Seventh Son, Red Prophet, The Memory of Earth, Songmaster, The Worthing Saga, and many, many other works of fiction, in addition to two books on writing, Character and Viewpoint, and How to Write Science Fiction and Fantasy. For those of you who have read his books, I'm sure you're as happy as I am to have a chance to talk with Orson Scott Card today. For those of you who haven't discovered him yet, we'll try to give you a reason to do so during this hour. Ender's Game, one of Card's first novels, has sold more than 1 million copies and has to be considered one of the most popular science fiction novels ever published. Ender's Game won both the Hugo and Nebula Awards for Best Novel in 1986, and the next year its sequel, Speaker for the Dead, also won the Hugo and Nebula Awards, the first time a novelist won both awards 2 years in a row. Orson Scott Card has written 3 sequels to Ender's Game, and in addition a new parallel novel entitled Ender's Shadow, and it's just published by Tor Books, as are, I believe, all of his books. Or at least all the science fiction books. His new book tells the same story as Ender's Game, but from the viewpoint of a different character, hence the concept of a parallel novel. During this hour, we'll talk with Orson Scott Card about those books, about his other works, and as much as we have time for, I'll ask my own questions. But one of the reasons for doing this show is to allow you, the listener, to ask your own questions. You can join our conversation by calling us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 or 333-WILL, if that makes it easier to dial. Also, we have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around Illinois or Indiana or the other places our signal travels, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL and toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. A couple of the things to say about Orson Scott Card. Original novel, Ender's Game, is currently in the process of being developed for film by Robert Chartoff, co-producer of The Right Stuff and other very well-known movies, and Orson Scott Card is writing the screenplay for that. His works have been translated into many languages. He's a recipient of 4 Locus Awards and a World Fantasy Award, in addition to winning the Hugo and Nebula Awards. He's written contemporary novels, alternative history novels, and historical novels, and is a playwright, having seen a dozen of his plays come to life. He's also taught writing courses at several universities, including most recently a novel writing course at Pepperdine College, and has taught many workshops around the country. And we're glad to have him join us by telephone in Chicago, where he's on tour. And speaking of that, he will be visiting Champaign-Urbana, or Savoy more particularly, on Saturday afternoon this week, Saturday 2 to 4 at Pages for All Ages bookstore in Savoy. And if you'd like a chance to meet him, to hear him do some reading and get any books signed, you'll have a chance to do so on Saturday. We're pleased to have him join us this morning. Orson Scott Card, good morning.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I enjoy your books a great deal, and this is really a thrill for me.
I have no idea what a thrill for me it is to talk to somebody in the media who has actually read my book.
Well, I imagine there are a lot of people out there who have read a lot. In fact, I was talking with someone who teaches writing here and mentioned that you were going to be visiting, and he said that his teenage son has read every single one of your books.
Oh, well, that's fun.
Yeah.
Of course, why hasn't the dad?
Well...
No, actually, I don't really regard it as a duty for people to read my work. Most people live long, full, and happy lives without reading anything of mine. But those who do enjoy it, I'm glad when they do.
Right. Well, let me start by asking you to talk about this concept of a parallel novel, because it's really, really interesting. I'm not sure I've seen this done before. Ender's Game being... Is Ender's Game, that's your first novel?
No, it was the first one to really find a wide following, but it was something like my 8th or 9th novel.
Oh, okay.
So it takes a while to learn how to do this sort of thing. So.
Okay.
But with Ender's Shadow, Ender's Game had never really had a sequel. I know that as you already said, it has 3 sequels, but those take place many years in the future, many years after the original book, and the character of Ender in the first book is a child, and he's definitely an adult in the later books. So that in a way, for readers who really love the story of Ender Wiggin in the in battle school as a child, learning how to command armies in space, there was no sequel to that. That story was simply not continued, and it really couldn't be because that book ended the whole situation. So the only way to go back into that world and explore it any further was to write not a sequel, but either a prequel, which didn't particularly interest me, or a parallel novel telling basically the same major events, but from the point of view of a different character, which does turn it into a completely different story.
Yeah.
So that's what we've done. For those who know Ender's Game, it's the character Bean, whose life we follow and track him from the beginning of Ender's Game's story to nearly the end.
It's a very powerful way of retelling the story. And what's interesting about it is once you've read Ender's Game, you basically know the story, although, you know, each character has a different set of stories to tell. But you know how it's going to turn out, but yet it still has the dramatic impact that it does.
Well, the fun part was to create a story that still had some suspense and tension when the major events' outcomes were known. I worked very hard to try to write Ender's Shadow in such a way that people who have never read Ender's Game or actually never read anything of mine will be able to make perfect sense of it and won't even miss the other book. I'd like to think, of course, that those who have read Ender's Game will find it quite refreshing and surprising what they learn in Ender's Shadow. But but it's as good an entry point to the books as the original Ender's Game.
It's such a powerful story, and I think that one of the reasons I'm so impressed by it, and your other books as well, is it's Ender's Game is a science fiction novel. It, you know, I don't want to give away too much because you know I'm in danger of if I talk too much about you know the outcome of it, I don't, you know, certainly don't want to go there. But it involves a battle between humanity on Earth and another species of life that feel they have to annihilate each other, or they're in this contest. And the challenge for Earth is to develop the capability of defeating this other species, and they do so essentially by manipulating the children.
Right. The theory is that children will fight with a more sort of a hell for leather attitude than adults will. Adults having more concept of the consequences of their actions, it becomes harder for them to just give all out. At the same time, children's, as anyone who's played video games against a child knows, children have much faster reflexes and can think more quickly, so that if you can turn war into something like a video game, then children will be able to respond much better to the training, won't have as many preconceptions, and so forth. But the funny thing is, some people have treated this as if it were a rather outlandish idea, but basically it is what we already do. Science fiction thrives not by inventing brand new things, but by exaggerating the way that our society already functions. We do send our children off to war. They're 18-year-old children instead of 9-year-old children, but we do rely on their fast reflexes and their greater willingness to put their own lives at risk and to throw themselves into a heroic cause. And just because I exaggerated in science fiction doesn't change the fundamental reality of the situation. Just clarifies it.
Is it too much just to extend that and say that modern warfare has become much like a video game?
It has. Since I wrote the original Ender's Game, it's come to fruition in some surprising ways that I certainly didn't predict. But I don't even want to say that Ender's Game is just a novel about war, because it really isn't.
Right.
We often treat our children that we send to school much the way that the kids in battle school are treated. My heart aches for children whose parents are so determined that those kids are going to thrive in college and get the best prep school and so forth, that the kids are actually being tested and probed and pushed into career-like activities long before they're old enough to even feel ambition for themselves. And I've watched some children who really have suffered from their parents pushing, and that's, I think, one of the reasons why Ender's Game has been responded to so much by young people. It was never intended to be a children's book or even a book for teenagers, but it found an audience there, partly because it expresses much of the dilemma that so many children feel that they face, where they're being pushed by adults into situations that are way too difficult for them to deal with many times, or at least so challenging that it takes a lot of the fun out of their childhood.
And they're thrust into a situation where they are forced to compete against each other.
Oh, yes.
And to see who rises to the top.
And some children thrive on that, but I know that I didn't. In fact, I remember that when I was young, I really loved to run and play outdoors and be out in the sun. And then I discovered, as school began to take over the play activities of children, that I wasn't very good at those things. I loved doing them, but I wasn't good. And it took all the joy out of it to know that every time I had to compete at running or at any kind of sports activity, I was going to fail. And I stopped doing it. I holed up with a book and stopped my outdoor life basically until just a couple of years ago. And that is kind of sad because I feel cheated out of a lot of years of a different kind of life just because the competitive aspect of it kind of ruined it for me.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, we're talking about elements of this story. These children thrust into this horrible situation and they're forced, almost manipulated into competing with each other. For those who haven't read the novel, that's sort of a hint about some of the key elements. Well, the thing I started to say initially was it's not so much the science fiction premise that it makes the story so interesting, but the humanity of the characters and their reactions to these situations that they find themselves in. And, oftentimes if you just look at someone from the outside in a horrible scenario, you don't get an idea of the emotional impact that it's having on them. And one thing that you draw very, very clearly out of your characters is the interior life that is in response to the exterior situation they're in.
It's the interior life of my characters that's my primary interest in all of my fiction, perhaps sometimes to excess, but we never let people know really what's going on inside ourselves, and as often as not, we don't even understand what's going on inside ourselves. So that's what I feel is worth exploring, and I think that's part of the reason why Ender's Game in particular, but my science fiction in general, is often regarded as being science fiction for people who don't think they like science fiction, because it's not about the hardware, and it's not about the cool ideas, though I'd like to think that every now and then I have a cool idea, and that the hardware is at least adequately presented, but what interests me is the human dilemma, the sufferings and strivings of characters. That's where the moral value, I think, of fiction comes from, is why people do the things they do, which things are worth showing and which things are worth suffering for.
Is that why you like to write?
Well, of course, the cheap answer is I like to write because it's the only thing I ever found that people would pay me to do.
Yeah.
But in truth, it's why I like telling stories, whether it's through writing or some other means. That's what interests me about storytelling, and I think it's an important endeavor. There's not a society on Earth that doesn't have some kind of fictional storytelling as an activity that people will do rather than eat sometimes. It's something that human beings hunger for, and I enjoy being able to produce some of the stories that satisfy some people's hunger.
To characterize you as a science fiction writer seems to me to be to unfairly narrow the kinds of work that you've done. And in particular, I'm struck by the book Seventh Son and the subsequent novels in that series, the Alvin Maker series, which is a sort of an alternative history of the early part of the United States history. Stemming from I don't remember exactly what year.
Starts about 1800.
Yeah.
And so far we're up to about 1830. We'll head to 1840 before the main character dies and the series ends. No secret there, by the way. All of my series end with the death of my hero because that's how I know it's over. You basically take my structure from biography, but that's also the reason why almost everything I write begins with children, because that's where life begins. But that series is a lot of fun for me because, in my mind, it's a historical novel. I'm dealing with the pivotal formative period of American culture, but I use the techniques of science fiction and fantasy to exaggerate, to make it an alternate history, where America is not one nation, but rather really three chunks that follow different traditions, and the main movements of American history, though, are all still there, and I think I do a pretty good job of exploring those issues that tore at America during those early years, the treatment of Indians, the treatment of slaves, the issues of religion and religious freedom that were really vital issues in that period.
Well, it's really fascinating how it's almost like the rules of the game are somewhat different, though, because a lot of the folk magic that is within our folklore, a lot of it, it works.
Well, what I'm doing is trying to create a history as if things that people believed worked really had worked.
Yes.
I mean, people used hexes and believed in casting spells and curses and,
right.
and dowsing and phrenology and all kinds of other pseudoscience or magic. I don't think they actually work. I'm bothered sometimes, in fact, by the number of readers I have who do believe in those things, and I have to point out to them that it does say fantasy on the cover, but I don't believe it. If I believed in it, it would say history, and it would be in a shelved in a different section, I think New Age religion or something like that. But the ability to use those motifs in history is a powerful one for telling stories, because it does awaken that sense of wonder that is sort of the mainstay of science fiction and fantasy. But even in fantasy, I find that the real value of it comes from the fact that good fantasies always have real-world analogs. That for example, I wrote a novel, a fantasy novel once, in which the price of magic was paid in blood, that shedding the, you know, killing a fly and using its ichor would give you the power to stop soup from boiling over. You know, killing a deer would allow you to become invisible. But the most terrible power would come from somebody willing to kill their own child. And you know, an unbearable thought, and allowed me to create quite a monstrous but fascinating character in the story. But even that has its real-world analogs. When people seek power in our culture, they often do it at the expense of their children. And while it's not literally bloodshed, people are quite content some of us aren't, to let their children have distorted or destroyed childhoods for the sake of the parents pursuing their ambitions. And, you know, I don't want to point any fingers, but we've seen some presidents who've run for office at a youthful enough age that their children paid kind of a hard price for their running for office. But many a corporate climber has done the same. It's not quite as famous, but their kids are in some way sacrificed on that altar. So, you know, it's not that I write science fiction and fantasy in order to be allegorical, but the allegory is self-contained within it without any particular effort on my part. And I find, in retrospect, looking back on my fictions, that I find much of the strength that they have, much of the power that the readers who enjoy them find there, comes from the fact that the truth is being told, even if in an exaggerated form.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation, and I'll just mention again our guest during this hour, Focus 580, Orson Scott Card, author of many science fiction and fantasy books, including Ender's Game, which is perhaps his best-known novel, although many others I'm sure folks are familiar with, and his latest book, Ender's Shadow, a parallel novel to Ender's Game, just published by Tor Books. And he'll be at Pages for All Ages in Savoy on Saturday from 2 to 4 o'clock. And you can attend that and listen to him do some reading and talk with him. And you can also talk with us during this hour by calling around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-WILL. We have a listener in Champaign to talk with on line number 1. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. I'm calling to primarily say to Orson Scott Card that I've read absolutely every book that I've ever seen written by him, and by far is my favorite author.
Oh, well, thank you.
I think the thing that attracts me most to your work is the way morality and humanity is discussed. And earlier in the show, you spoke about the inner life of the characters as being important. What has always struck me as amazing is the way that you seem to draw on your own spirituality and family in your characters. For example, in Lost Boys, I think there's even something talked about in that. But the clarity in which those our deepest emotions are expressed is absolutely amazing.
Well, I'm glad that you appreciate that. I'm bringing up the idea of family and spirituality. Those are actually two themes that I think are kind of underrepresented, certainly not unrepresented, but underrepresented in American fiction, not just science fiction, but fiction in general today. And I think part of it is that it's just hard. When you're dealing with family, every time you introduce a major character that's in close relationship with other characters in the story, it transforms every other character, and it becomes almost unwieldy after a while. If you have a family with more than a few family members, it becomes almost unwieldy to work with them. And so it's often simply easier to simplify the family, to have just a couple or a couple with one child or two. A notable exception to this, of course, is Anne Tyler, who is absolutely brilliant at writing the domestic novel. She's one of my mentors as I read her fiction. And in science fiction especially, we have so much of the adolescent hero. Even if he's 35 or 40, he still functions as an adolescent because he's connected to no one, seems to have had no parents, no siblings, no spouse, relationships that come and go, you know, the man who can't commit. But he comes into town like Beowulf in the first part of the saga, kills the monster, and then, unlike Beowulf, rides away into the sunset and is not seen again in those parts. That hero is easy to write. He is what he does, has no connections, and he's gone, moves on to the next adventure. But when you write about somebody who stays, somebody who is an adult, who marries, has children, commits to a community, and sticks around for the consequences of his actions, it's quite a different kind of story, often less adventurous. I mean, how many parents think of themselves as adventurous? In fact, as soon as you have children, you're almost held hostage by their existence to being less daring and less bold. But that's also where human life is centered. That's what holds human communities together, is that bond with between the generations and the people who create the next generation. And you mentioned spirituality. That's another area that gets ignored. People tend to shy away from religion now in our fiction, even though I've never met a person who didn't have deeply held religious beliefs. They might call themselves atheistic, but in fact, most people who pronounce themselves atheists are quite religious about it, and in fact, often fanatical, showing some of the extremes of people who are rather intolerant in their religious beliefs, in the sense that they believe that anyone who does not agree with them simply is either stupid or evil, which is the mark of fanaticism and closed-mindedness, as far as I can tell. So when I'm writing my fiction, I try to include both the family life and the spiritual life of my characters simply as part of an accurate portrayal of what human beings are like.
I believe that certainly comes through, at least for me, this reader. Thank you so much for your work, and I hope you continue for a long, long time.
Oh, well, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call. We have a couple other calls to talk with. Let's move right on to listener in Urbana on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I read Ender's Game and the following books several years, a long time ago, whatever that means. And I cannot remember what age I would pitch them for. I remember recommending them to my sons, but now I've got some nephews. And do you have any suggestions for youngest age level for?
Well, the truth is children sort of sort themselves out when they're approaching Ender's Game. It really is not a children's book. I mean, there is sometimes there's language in it that children actually use. I was fairly accurate there, but that often disturbs parents. And there are some parents who are troubled by that. And I would want to make sure people understand that this book is not written for children. It's not, quote, child safe, unquote, in every respect, though I hand it to my own children, certainly. I wrote it when my oldest son was 5, and I gave it to him to read when he was 7, and he read it and loved it at that age. So it's partly the reading level of the child, so that obviously the brighter the child is, the younger that he can read it, and the more likely he is to identify with it. I say he, but there are as many girls who like it as boys. But it's also very popular, and this surprised me. I never would have imagined this, but I get a lot of letters from either the kids themselves or from their parents or teachers. Children who have behavioral problems or learning disabilities, many kids who are in classes for kids who just aren't making it in school, and they'll be handed Ender's Game by a teacher or a friend, and for many of these kids, it's the first book without pictures they've ever read in their lives. But they read it with the same kind of fervent intensity as many kids who are quite gifted and feel isolated from their peers because of that. And I think it is because of the social dynamic of the story, the kid in isolation who doesn't feel like he really is among friends, or at least doesn't get the kind of treatment that one would expect from a loving family, for example. And so for those kids who are hungry for that kind of story, Ender's Game speaks to them. And I think everybody finds this, I think, that kids will read way above grade level if they care about the story. They'll read very slowly, maybe, But I remember my daughter, when she was 7, reading the Anne of Green Gables books, and even though those are pitched to be young adult-type books, they're certainly not meant for 7-year-olds. And it was tough sledding to read something that difficult. But kids will look up the words or guess at their meaning. If they care enough about the story, they'll read whatever they want. So it's really a matter of knowing the child that you're giving the books to. Truth is, I intended Ender's Game for adult readers. The standard rule in young adult fiction is that if you want 10-year-olds to read a book, the hero has to be 12. Well, who is Ender's Game for when the hero starts out at age 5? You know, it's definitely not a book for 3-year-olds. So it doesn't follow the rules, and I guess it's really up to kids themselves to decide whether they're ready to read it.
Well, I think you've covered the territory pretty well. So
well, thank you. My terrible disease here is that when somebody asks me a question, I tend to answer it so exhaustively that there's no time for any other. Sorry about that.
Well, but it is. It just depends on the kid, and I think you covered some very good points. And I can remember reading huge books in I don't remember what grades, but actually having teachers tell me they were too old for me and that were beyond my ability, and I was really insulted because I was enjoying reading them and handling them the way you describe. And, you know, if a kid isn't ready for it, they won't read it.
Yeah, well, it's so funny when people tell you, when you're enjoying the book, they tell you it's too old for you, and you go, oh, really? Well, then why do I like it?
Well, I enjoyed reading it as an adult, and at the same time, I thought it had interesting things to talk about with my kids. And as I said, I can't remember all the details now, but I really highly recommend that book. And I'm looking forward to Ender's Game. Ender's Shadow. I happened to see it in the bookstore the other day, and I think I'm going to see what I can do about getting it for Christmas.
Oh well, I understand that booksellers often have good ideas about how you can get them.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call. We have a couple other listeners waiting, and we're a little past our midpoint. We're talking this hour with Orson Scott Card, author of many books, including Ender's Game, as we've been discussing, and his new book, Ender's Shadow, a parallel novel to Ender's Game. And we have about 23 minutes left or so, or a little less than that, if you'd like to join the conversation. We have two people waiting and room for others, 333-WILL around Champaign-Urbana, elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. We'll go to Bloomington, Illinois next, line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is that the writer feels sort of a kindred spirit with Harlan Ellison, who says that he more or less writes speculative fiction that transcends, let's say, a hard science fiction edge, and if you feel that sometimes science fiction actually ropes you in into areas that are not really complete.
Well, the science fiction itself, the science fiction literary community, puts no limits on a writer. In fact, it's the most free literary community there is. There are really rigid formulaic limits, I find, in literary fiction, whereas in science fiction I can do what I please, and whatever story I care about and believe in, I can tell in whatever way I think is appropriate for it, and I'll find at least some portion of the science fiction audience that's perfectly happy to go right along and see what I'm doing. The only way that science fiction imposes limits on the writer is commercially and academically. Because it's a category, because people who don't read within the category often don't understand it, there is a sort of a mindset in the academic literary establishment that science fiction is literature with lurid covers and shallow writing. And in some ways, they certainly can see signs of that in the covers, of course, were lurid, and some still are, but we don't write within science fiction. We don't use the same tools, rather, that are the mainstays of literary fiction. Metaphor is more difficult in science fiction because it might be true. You know, when you say a phrase, I think the most colorful example was somebody writing the sentence, she turned on her left side. In literary fiction, that would be literal. But in science fiction, it has the potential of meaning that she reached down and flipped a switch to activate her left side. Metaphors. I remember a story by Walter John Williams where he talked about how the serpentine bus snaked out to the aircraft. And I'm not quoting it exactly because in fact, I think he didn't say serpentine. I think he said the serpent bus slithered out to the aircraft, And it conjured up the image, because we were reading science fiction, of a literally reptilian transportation device. Metaphor becomes complicated because it might be real, especially early in a story. And so you often find science fiction written in what I would call the tradition of the American plain style, where metaphor is shunned, figures of speech are avoided, and instead you simply tell the story as plainly and clearly as possible. There's nothing wrong with that style, but it doesn't fit the paradigms that are most admired in our academic literary establishment, and science fiction takes a bad rap for being bad writing. The result is that science fiction writers are treated often as second-class citizens, and their works as sub-literature or secondary literature in the universities. Commercially speaking, the limitation is simply that once you're in a category, it's hard to write out of category. It's hard to publish out of category because the bookstores don't know where to shelve your books. My historical novel, Saints, is absurdly shelved with science fiction and fantasy as often as not, because that's where most of my books are, and the bookstore people feel that that's where my readers will be looking for me. But that means that I can never find new readers for my historical novel because it isn't in the same section as the historical novels would otherwise be. And so it poses a limitation on the writer that is extremely difficult to escape, and I don't know the answer to that. Harlan's answer was to deny that he wrote science fiction, which, while I understand the impulse behind it, is simply not true. He does write science fiction. He also writes other things, but in his effort to shun the label, he has sometimes sounded as if, though I don't think he means it this way, as if he had something less than high regard for the literary community that nurtured his career. I know that that's not true of him. He really does have strong ties with and affection for the science fiction literary community. But I can understand the desire to break free. There are books I'd like to write that I can't publish.
Hope the last caller will forgive me, but I want to include as many people as we can before we run out of time.
And I'm babbling too long. I'll try to control myself.
It's better than a guest who utters monosyllables, believe me. So, no, we appreciate your answers, so that's fine. We'll go next to a listener, though, in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
I would like to pick up from what the last caller was saying, because I think it's important that we get our best writers doing their best work, and I'm always looking forward to seeing you move into what is accepted as mainstream, although, as you say, Harlan Ellison always argued that what he was writing was fiction and not science fiction. It didn't matter what he was writing. It was always intended to be written and read by the general audience. And I was just wondering, when you said that there were projects that you were interested in that you couldn't get published, is that going to keep you from writing them?
For the time being, yes, because I have a payroll to meet, several assistants who work for me, and financial responsibilities that say that if there are three or four different projects that are really ripe and ready for me to create, and one of them will bring in no money, and one of them will bring in a little, and two of them will bring in a lot, just take a wild guess which ones I'll do. I've never written anything that I didn't believe in and care about. I don't write for money in the sense that I write something that I would otherwise not have written. And in another sense, I really can write whatever I want to, as long as I simply make sure that there is a fantasy element integrated into it. So that my novel Lost Boys is my sort of autobiographical novel on my move to the South in 1983 and on some of the turmoil in our family at that time. But because of a supernatural element, it can be safely published within the sort of contemporary fantasy genre. It's a contemporary novel, but because of the presence of ghosts in it, I'm able to publish it in category, and everybody's happy in the bookstores, and academia considers itself safe from my incursion. I think the only place where... I have to say that the category in the bookstores is actually not a bad thing, because people who want to be part of the science fiction community don't have to wade through every book. They can go straight to the science fiction section and find books that are written in a similar style or vocabulary or using the same kinds of motifs that they want to have a repeated experience of. Likewise, somebody who wants to avoid Westerns and science fiction and romances and so forth can head for the, quote, literature category, unquote, in the bookstores and find books that will satisfy them. So those categories don't do harm only. And as long as a writer still, as you suggest, writes what he cares about and believes in, whether it's going to get published or not, then he's not being really punished by it. I could publish some of these other projects, in editions of 3,000 self-published. Nothing's stopping me from doing that. I have a tendency, though, to want to reach as many different readers as possible.
And, well, I haven't finished the whole book, I must confess. I think the End of Shadow may be the best thing you've written.
I'd sure like to think so.
I was really excited by it because I think it really it not only went back to what I saw in the Ender's Game novel, but even the things that I liked so much in the original Ender's Game novella. It gets close to dealing with issues of childhood in ways that I think most of the so-called mainstream fiction doesn't. And this is exceptional.
Well, see, science fiction and fantasy give us tools to write with, we who write within it, that simply aren't available to the literary writers, just as they have some tools that aren't available to us. I like the idea that both traditions exist side by side. I just wish that the one didn't bully the other as badly as the academic literary establishment does. I wish that they'd just treat us with respect as a valid alternative way of creating literature.
We have about 10 minutes left with Orson Scott Card, author of many works of science fiction and fantasy, including Ender's Game, as we've mentioned, and his newest book, Ender's Shadow, a parallel novel to Ender's Game. And we have one caller waiting, time for probably a couple others if you'd like to join the conversation. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana, anywhere else, 800-222-9455. We'll go next to a listener in Champaign on line number two. Good morning, you're on Focus 580.
Hi. I want to ask just some pretty basic questions about Ender's Shadow. It seems fairly obvious that you learned things about the character of Bean that you didn't know before. But I was wondering, without wanting you to give too much away to people who haven't read it yet, how much of Bean's character did you know before? Bean was always my favorite sub-character in Ender's Game, and I was curious... did you know anything of his background? Did you know some of it?
The answer is simple. I knew none whatsoever. Every writer knows when you're creating fiction that there are placeholder characters, that characters that really aren't in your outline, that aren't part of the main theme of the story, that you bring in because they're needed to perform a function in the story, and that's what Bean was in the original novella of Ender's Game. When I created the expanded novel... Well, the areas that I expanded were not the areas Bean was in, so really he didn't amount to much more in the novel than he had in the novella. I liked the character, I just didn't know much about him and didn't need to. He was a romantic figure in the sense that his character consisted of what he actually did in the story. So going back and inventing the character with this recent novel, the hard task was really not coming up with fresh things to have his character mean. It was fitting them somehow into the structure that I'd imposed on him in the previous book. There were so many times that I wished I could go back and just change a sentence or two in Ender's Game in order to make the character fit just a little bit better the way that I'd finally discovered him to be. But I finally followed my own rules and fit him within the dialogue that I already had, that I had to have him say. But that was a hard problem, the fact that I had not known any of this material when I wrote the original book.
Well, I just want to say that you are one of my favorite writers, like all the other gushing people who have called.
Well, the people who really hate my work are so unlikely to telephone. Right?
But I really loved Ender's Shadow a lot. I'm really glad to see it. I never thought that there would be anything that would approach that story again, so I was pleased and surprised, and I thought it was fantastic.
Well, thank you. I hope I can do it again when I tackle the character of Petra.
Oh, are you really going to do
that? Yeah, that's
oh, really?
Not the next
oh,
book.
God.
The next book is Shadow of the Hegemon, which tells the story of Bean as he is the commander that Peter uses to try to unite the world under one government so that we get to actually explore the character of Ender's older brother, Peter. And then Petra will be the subject of the next Ender book that I do.
I'm truly happy to hear that. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Does Achilles figure in this plan, or is that...
Just the very idea that he might exist at the end of the book gives those things away.
Right. Okay. All right.
We'll try not to put too many spoilers here, but yes, of course, he's
okay.
In it.
All right. Well, I hope I have time to ask a couple more questions myself, but I will defer to our callers and next up a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. May I touch on three different areas?
Oh, if there's time.
Understanding, or isn't the Alexandria Quartet by Durrell similar to what you've done?
I know that it exists. I've never read it. I own it, but I've never gotten around to reading it. But yes, I think that that is the same story told four times from four different characters' point of view.
So it's not that it's unique. It's,
no, it just isn't done often.
It's done because this is like juggling four things that are each very difficult to do.
Right, and it's especially hard when you didn't plan it that way from the beginning. Durrell planned it that way. That was his whole point in writing the four volumes. Whereas in this one, I never imagined when I was writing Ender's Game that I'd do this.
Secondly, do you know this television series, The Pretender?
You know, I watched one episode once, and I know the basic premise of it.
As it's focused, it's on the adult who is sort of totipotent. But one of the themes is that because the ends justify the means, children are kidnapped and, in effect, kindly tortured to become what it is their kidnappers wish them to become.
See, I didn't get that premise. I think I came in after the opening of the episode, so I didn't realize that was part of the premise of The Pretender.
Many episodes further on, they go back into how the Pretender was trained, and I'm not sure quite what the word verb is to what you do with kids.
Well, but the fact is we socialize children.
Because of the theme of what we do with children ends justifying the means. Those who walk away from Omelos, you know, that short story.
Well, you can take it grimly, or you can... You know, I am kind of a communitarian rather than a libertarian, and I believe that while the effort to socialize ourselves does require that we knock some edges off of individuals, and it can certainly be carried to extremes. I'm not the kind of guy who could ever go through military basic training, for example. Nevertheless, we do have to train our children to, for example, handle their bodily functions in privacy rather than in public, and the things that we all take for granted that are actually quite difficult for children to learn. So we do impose our will on our children, and often it's not a pretty sight while it's going on. But the question always is, how far do you go? Where do you find the balance between the individual's freedom and the need of the community for conformity? Sometimes we sway too far one direction, sometimes too far another. Our tolerance of our current president, for example, to me is way off the charts in the wrong direction, forgiving the unforgivable in a social leader. But you can go way too far the other direction and end up trying to make everybody fit into lockstep behavior that is unbearable for individuals, and either direction ends up destroying a community that tries to go too far that way.
And finally, I'm intrigued by the process by which the short version of the original story becomes a novel. Why did you go back to it? What was missing from the short story?
Which is going to sound
like a jab in the face, and go into the novel form, which is like trying to go around with a professional boxer in one shot.
I love the comparisons, but
the process to expand.
Well, the reason was practical. I was writing Speaker for the Dead as a sequel to the novelette of Ender's Game, and I found that I could not begin Speaker for the Dead in a reasonable place because I had to spend so much time correcting the ending of Ender's Game. So instead, I simply rewrote Ender's Game as a novel in order to set up Speaker for the Dead, which is ironic because then Ender's Game, to my complete surprise, went on to win awards. And I was thinking, oh, no, the real novel is Speaker for the Dead. Nobody's going to pay any attention to this book now that it's just a sequel to an award-winning novel. But kindly enough, people went ahead and paid attention to Speaker for the Dead in its own right, and I appreciated that. But it was just the practical consideration of how to set up Speaker for the Dead that made me go back and novelize the novella.
We have about 5 minutes left with Orson Scott Card. If folks would like to call us real quick, we'll try to get you in, 333-9455. Or 800-222-9455. A thing that strikes me as so interesting about your characters, and I'm thinking of not just the Ender's Game series of books or the Alvin Maker series, also the Memory of Earth and that series as well. And I haven't read all your books, but the ones I have, I fell in love with very, very quickly. But the thing about your characters is they're all confused. They have doubts about their core. Most of the key characters are trying to do the right thing, even faced with very grave circumstances, but they still have that ambivalence. Do you think that this is a central part of being human, that doubt is universal to us?
Well, what I think is the central part of human existence is that even if you're trying to be good, it's so hard to know what good is. You know, people talk about writing about good versus evil. That's the most of the time. That's the easiest decision to make. When evil is obvious and good is obvious, most people choose good if they can, unless they really aren't in control of their own impulses very well. But most of the time, what we're faced with is not good versus evil, but sort of good versus sort of good. And the good will cost something, and there'll be a price to pay, and it's hard to know whether it's worth the price. And you always second guess yourself, wondering if only I had chosen the other way, how would things have turned out differently? And that's the human dilemma, is that we just don't know outcomes. We can't tell what the cause and effect of anything really is, and what the result of anything is going to be. So we're stuck in that permanent state of holding everything in abeyance, never knowing how it's going to come out. That's what I think the function of fiction is that in fiction, you get set answers, you get final answers, in the sense that you're never going to go back and uncover facts that undo your understanding of the story. You know, with news stories, with history, the discovery of a new fact can always alter our whole understanding of what the event actually meant. But with fiction, it's set. The author gave us a final answer about what that means. You can't say about Huckleberry Finn that the real reason he didn't report Jim as a runaway slave was because he intended to sell him for a higher price farther down the river. There's just no justification for that. We know the motive for Huck's behavior because what Twain said on that subject is final. And in fiction, we get final answers about why people do the things they do. But for me, the fun is the puzzles along the way, the self-torment that the character goes through in trying to figure out what to do and then how to live with the consequences of what he did.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about the inclusion of spirituality and religion in your work. And, you know, even characters such as Reverend Thrower in Seventh Son, etc., they're in an ambiguous situation. They're someone who, you know, he's someone who's trying to do the right thing by his own reckoning. But there's a certain sort of hypocrisy about him that isn't, but it's not thorough hypocrisy. It's very interesting because of the circumstance he finds himself in and the worldview that he has. And he's not able to really make sense of everything. And it strikes me as he's a tragic and yet a very sympathetic character.
He strikes me that way too. I didn't even mean him to be that way. He just grew on me. I find so many people like him who want to do well but get their ambition confused with their faith.
Mm-hmm.
And that really is, you know, he wants to be smarter than everybody else, but he also wants to be good and humble. And where do you find a balance in your life? And so I'm probably going to do some work on him in the last two volumes of that series. I think I'm going to bring him back and maybe redeem him a little bit while taking some others apart. It's not a game, really. It's that I care about him, and I think that he really would try to redeem himself.
Well, there's much more we could talk about, and I'm sorry to say that we're out of time for now, and we'll just simply suggest to folks listening that you should look for Ender's Shadow, the newest book by Orson Scott Card, and he's got many books, so if you'd like to check them out, you can find them in bookstores and libraries. And also, folks have a chance to meet Orson Scott Card, those of you around Champaign-Urbana, Champaign County, this Saturday from 2 to 4 o'clock at Pages for All Ages bookstore in Savoy. 2 to 4, he'll be giving a reading and a signing there. And so feel free to attend that. And to you, Orson Scott Card, thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for a wonderful conversation. I enjoyed myself immensely.
We will leave it there, and time to hand things off. It's getting close to the end of the morning, and that means that Afternoon Magazine is coming up. Jay Pierce is hosting that show today, and Jay, what have you got coming?